IPFA benefit. Tuesday, June 12th, 7:30 p.m. The church has wheelchair access, and there is free parking just behind it. Tickets at Marcus Books, brownpapertickets.com, and our other supportive indie bookstores. Find more info on the KPFA website. For Darnell Moore and Greg Bridges, June 7th.
And you are listening to 94.1 KPFA and 89.3 KPFB in Berkeley, 88.1 KFCF in Fresno, 97.5 K248BR in Santa Cruz, and online at kpfa.org. The time is 2 p.m. Stay tuned next for the Visionary Activist Show.
Welcome, allies, to the Visionary Activist Show, and I'm your weaver of context, Caroline Casey. Just back from the United Astrology Congress in Chicago, more on that in ensuing weeks, but where I was very often saying, oh humans, oh keepers of esoteric lore and arcane knowledge and much philosophy and the history of humans, you know, let us tease this into pertinence, into application. I like, you know, as one of my criteria, the world is on fire, and your point would be, not to reduce it. Somebody could say, my point is, I like planting flowers. And we go, good for you, but just keep it as a criterion. So more than perfectly at this dangerous time to be fully informed, you know, we are hosting Gary Lachman, who just, his author page is perfectly great, is the author of many books. I have them, many of them, on the links between consciousness, culture, and the Western inner tradition, including Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, Beyond the Robot, The Life and Work of Colin Wilson, and The Secret Teachers of the Western World. We are now highlighting, it came out yesterday, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. And it is essential. I think it's essential reading. I do. I'm not inflating. I think it's one of the most crucial books to read now to understand where we are and how we got here. His website is garylachman.co.uk. And he is a founding member of the rock group Blondie as well. Welcome, Gary.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on.
Oh, a pleasure. Completely. My goodness. So there's so many places to go, and I loved your background. I think we want to feed in a little bit of background about what gave rise to Trump. Hmm. And already you've helped me shift metaphors, because I've been to CPAC, the Conservative Political Action Conference, to go speak with Dementors. And informed interesting conservatives too, and I did go to both conventions. And after hearing Trump speak, you know, the con man versus the liberating trickster, in which he was saying what you're saying, you know, he said, "I will bring to you the greatest desire you've had since you were born," and I did. I sank to my knees, going, "Oh, we are so smoked on what should be our strong suit of invitation to the desirable story." And I thought of Dion Fortune and the witches and wizards in World War II in England, you know, weaving a little spell of protection over England, but not with a lot of humor, but still we draw on all these things. So to you, you call Trump a chaos magician, which is, I think, just right. And however you want to jump in on that.
Okay. Well, I mean, the thing is, what I discovered when I was started to look at all this stuff, because basically my publisher at the time, Mitch Horowitz, who was at Penguin, and he's since moved on, because, you know, everything was in the news and we were just watching everything happen, and around the same time I was finishing the book I did just before this one, Lost Knowledge of the Imagination, and it seemed very provident, because just as I was doing the last chapter, which is the theme of it is the responsibility of the imagination, which is something I talk about at the very end of Dark Star Rising, it seemed that just as I was getting into that whole idea of the basically, you know, we need to be careful what's going on inside our heads, because unlike Vegas, what happens in the mind doesn't always stay there. and, you know, it goes out into the world. And just as I was, you know, writing about that, that's when all the, you know, Trump's election and all this stuff about Richard Spencer and the National Policy Institute meeting, you know, right after Trump's victory, which he greeted the audience with, you know, this hail Trump, hail our hero, and basically making the claim that he and, you know, members of, you know, his following, whether it was the NPI or the alt-right or whatever, just Trump supporters in general, had somehow willed him into office, had somehow, you know, used magic or mental power, or mental science, new thought in some way to get him into office. And that was sort of happened in the news because everyone saw the video of that meeting, the opening of that meeting. And then soon after that, you get, not too long into, you know, last year, what really made me feel like something really strange was going on, not just in terms of politics, but in terms of how we understand the world in general, was when the New York Times ran a story about a talk that Steve Bannon, who was at that time, this is February 2017, was still, you know, on Trump's bench. And in the talk, along with all the other things he talked about, like the global Tea Party movement and, terrorism and so on, he name checks Julius Evola. Now, if you know who Julius Evola is, that's a strange thing. It's a strange thing for the New York Times to be reporting. And Evola is a very brilliant, very controversial writer on esoteric themes in the 20th century, but he had very far right, extreme far right views. And in the 20s, he tried to curry favor with Mussolini, and then after that with the National Socialists. And on top of that, on top of just, you know, someone who's on Trump's bench and has his ear, saying basically that some of his views are informed by those of Evola's, he made this comment in the context of talking about Putin. Vladimir Putin, and saying, you know, sort of, kind of, he's sort of praising him and saying he's, you know, he's a bit wary, but he's an intelligent man. But what he liked about Putin, that was Putin was standing up for traditional values, you know, traditional sort of normal sort of values, unlike what was happening in the West and all that. And, but he says Putin has someone in his camp who reads Evola, and that someone is this character, Alexander Dugin, who is one of the most remarkable sort of esoteric political figures around today. So all of that was leading up to, okay, well, what's actually going on? And then, you know, it came out that Trump was a devotee of New Thought, positive thinking, Norman Vincent Peale. But what's the one word that characterized Trump's presidency so far? I mean, I think most people would say chaos. And so it suddenly struck me as I was reading about positive thinking and how they go about it, and then sort of getting all this sense that, you know, and the whole idea that Spencer and the alt-right had somehow used the internet, you know, to help Trump win, what they call meme magic, and sort of using sort of internet memes as a way to affect reality. When I started looking into chaos magic and then positive thinking and New Thought, although they're on the surface, they look very, very different. You know, when you get down to their actual techniques and their aims, it's very similar. But both are very results-driven, and both basically want to make things happen. It's not magic about sort of getting in touch with your higher self. It's not mysticism. It's basically about making things happen, having some kind of power. And to finish that up, it just struck me that even though Trump probably never ever heard of chaos magic until maybe recently, people talking about him in the context of it, his whole sort of MO, you know, the way he worked, his modus operandi was like very much like that. And so it seemed all these things seemed to kind of fit into place at the same time. And then the chaos theme, where you have Dugin, who's at different levels, at different degrees, his ideas are reaching Putin. And behind them is this notion of kind of creating this kind of global chaos, in the sense that it would be the downfall of the old world order, and we would, you know, level the field so that a new world can come up. So Trump seemed to be sort of acting out in a kind of natural, like very, you know, kind of just in his personality, in his character, something along the lines of what, you know, this chaos world that I had found myself in.
Yes. No, you talk about the secret meeting in Sweden where they go, he's the man of the hour. And maybe, you know, because when I sank to my knees in despair going, oh no. My metaphor, and I might be willing to compost it, was I thought that Trump was possessed. I like it as a metaphor without getting spooked out, possessed by a cunning demonic ingenious retrovirus, not to be underestimated, because it adapts to things. And what I find so crucial about your book and your dedication and your blazing lucidity is that so many of our team are so bamboozleable and snookerable, and you narrate an interesting passage, because many of us grew up with, you know, American prosperity stuff, right? And Think Like a Winner and Reverend Ike, if we can dream it up, we can dream it down, and, you know, and Ernest Holmes and all these people. And then let me toss it back to you as just a little bit of the roots of this, of how Trump so loves Norman Vincent Peale and the friend, the psychoanalyst, as you write, Smiley Blanto, who had studied with Freud, right? So this blending of psychology and religion, and critic of FDR and the New Deal, very important now, seeing it as an attack on individualism, and then this crucial kind of Ayn Rand and everything thing about a contempt for the weak, right? So let me toss it back to you, because the Ernest Holmes, Reverend Ike, the Kabbalion. Okay, I just want to. I love the Kabbalion, Paul Foster Case and Eliphas Levy. And you go, they're kind of cons, and we go, oh, that's fun too. All right, but let me toss it back to you with the roots of this, of Norman Vincent Peale and the think positive, think like a winner thing.
Well, that's, you know, Trump grew up with that.
Yeah.
Just one thing though, in the sort of names you were mentioning there, one of them, Eliphas Levy, he was actually, he was a blazing socialist. I mean, before he became a Kabbalist and was writing very, very popular and influential books about magic in the sort of 1860s, he was, he was a very fervent feminist and socialist, and he was arrested a few times. So I mention that because even though in this book I'm focusing on sort of occult politics happening in on the right side of the political spectrum here and now. In an earlier book, Politics and the Occult, I look at the history of sort of politics in the occult. And in that book, I question the idea that occult politics is always right wing. And you can find quite a bit of progressive occult politics as well, you know, what we would call progressive.
Which is
But just getting back to Trump, I mean, he grew up with, going to the Marble College at Collegiate Church on Fifth Avenue in New York. And his father was a big fan of Norman Vincent Peale. And I think the only two people really that Trump looked up to were his father and Peale. And, the kind of sermons Peale was giving. And the funny thing is, I remember when I was living in New York, I lived in New York in mid-70s and a bit of the early 80s. I remember walking past that church all the time on Fifth Avenue and sort of, you know, seeing the placard outside for Norman Vincent Peale and all that kind of thing. So it's very funny now to sort of be talking about him. But he just grew up on the whole idea that, if you set your mind on some goal, on some aim, and if you stick to it and you don't give up and you focus on it all the time, and you're really determined and you persevere, you'll achieve it. It'll happen. It is that kind of, stick-to-itness and being positive and having an affirmative outlook, an optimistic outlook, and all that sort of thing, which is very American. It's very can-do. I mean, it goes back, New Thought goes back to Ralph Waldo Emerson. The phrase New Thought came out of one of his essays. And, you know, Emerson is the American sort of philosopher, sort of par excellence in many ways, just in the sense that it's all about, self-motivation, we don't need to rely on the past. You don't need to rely on others. We can, self-reliance and all that sort of thing. And then also it gets picked up, some decades later by William James, who's the great American philosopher and psychologist and who practically, invented clinical psychology. But he was so convinced of the value of the sort of the early days of this new thought, it was called sort of the mind cure then, you know, the way you can sort of think yourself healthy, or at least to not put it so utilitarianly, just the idea that yes, our thoughts, our attitudes, what's going on inside our minds can have an effect on our health and basically, you know, our lives and the world out there.
Which is true.
Yeah, it is. Yeah, that's. I just. I mean, and in fact, you know, when it gets down to the very popular new thought sort of books like The Secret and all that, the ideas involved actually, you know, they start up in these very lofty metaphysical heights of you know, idealism, German idealism, and people like Kant and you know, Eastern philosophy, the Upanishads and things of that sort, and back to Hermeticism. You know, you mentioned the Kabbalion, which is this kind of faux, you know, Greek version of the Kabbalah, kind of just in the title, and it purports.
And I do just have to put in the margins here that you also dispel going, yes, the idea that tarot and the Hebrew alphabet and the Kabbalah are linked is a made up thing. It's like, wow.
Well, that was the thing with that. That's where I would say sort of the whole, because we're getting back to chaos magic again. Chaos magic is basically, instead of relying on all the traditional, you know, kind of accoutrements of magic, where you have to have, you know, the circle and the wand and the demon's name just right, and you know, getting all the little details down perfectly, the whole idea of a chaos magic is you use whatever's at hand, and you use your imagination and your own will. So anything can become a sort of magical tool or a weapon.
And then just backwards for a moment, and I'll toss it right back. But the positive syncretizing or cross-pollinating, you mentioned that, you know, Gandhi was profoundly moved by meeting Helena Blavatsky, and it was Emerson who read the Upanishads, and Gandhi read Emerson, which is how Gandhi found out about his own tradition of the Upanishads. And we go, no, that stuff, that part is cool.
Yeah, I mean, no, I mean, there's lots of, you know, I mean, as I said, Gandhi, or just to him, though, that hardly ever gets mentioned. I mean, nowadays it does, but earlier on, anything about him, it hardly ever get mentioned that when he met Madame Blavatsky and just before she died here in London, I mean, he was very busy trying to be Ben Kingsley. You know, he was dressed here, you know, we're, you know, very nice, you know, looking like an English lawyer and all that. And he met these two theosophists, and they were keen on everything Indian, everything Hindu. And they were really excited to have met him. And they basically said, oh, wouldn't it be wonderful if all three of us could read the Bhagavad Gita together in the original language?
Yeah.
And Gandhi had to admit that he had never read it in any language whatsoever. He was taught to, you know, that was all superstition by the Christian missionaries. And so they said, well, you must come meet Madame Blavatsky. And she basically introduced him to his own tradition. And from that day on to the end of his life, he always spoke well of theosophy. He was less interested in its occult side, but in the whole idea of this brotherhood of man, you know, regardless of sex, creed, color, you know, income, whatever, that was really Blavatsky's kind of mission. This comes out of sort of 18th and early 19th century Masonry.
Right.
But the thing about Levy is that he had this brilliant flash, you know, about the tarot, because there's 22 tarot trumps. And if you know the Kabbalah, and you know the main sort of symbol of the Kabbalah is the tree of life. And this is sort of it's a structure made of sort of three pillars, and there's nine what they call sephiroth, basically spheres that are, you know, lined up on these pillars. And in between the different spheres on this symbol of the tree of life, there are what they call different pads. And there's 22 of those. And each one of those is linked to the the Hebrew alphabet. And Levy just had this brilliant flash that, oh, 22 trumps, 22 pads, there must be some kind of link. And subsequent scholarship has shown that no, the tarot doesn't go back that far. It certainly doesn't go back to Egypt in the way that Levy talked about it. But it was a brilliant mistake that just became, it turned into like, well, actually, it's creative. And what's happened is that a lot of people have used this and it's worked for them. So it's the idea like, well, you don't necessarily have to stick by the rules. If you're creative enough and imaginative enough, you can make it happen. So that's kind of the roots, I would say, of this chaos magic idea. It's like, you know, and in many ways, it's like found art. It's like objet trouve, you know, where you pick something up on the street somewhere and it's just a piece of rubbish. When you take it home and you put it inside a box, or you put it on the mantelpiece or next to something, suddenly it becomes art. It becomes some kind of, you know, bric-a-brac or some, you know, item. And so similarly with chaos magic. You take some everyday item that has no immediate kind of magical connotations, but through your imagination, through your will and your own kind of initiative, it becomes one. And what's happened with the whole idea of the meme magic and using the internet was that the internet stuff on the internet is what's most at hand these days. You know, you mentioned when we were talking before, the show started about, I talk about chaos magic sort of coming up in London and around the same time as the punk was coming up, the Sex Pistols, you know, 75, 76, something like that. And the internet wasn't around then. So people were using stuff from sort of popular culture. And the symbol for chaos magic, the chaos star, is this eight-pointed star. I mean, that itself comes from fiction. It comes from a series of novels by the British writer Michael Moorcock, this series of books called The Eternal Champion. And it's basically about this fundamental war between order and chaos, which seems to be something that we've either woken up or find ourselves in now to some degree.
Right. Well, you also linked to the Brexit as that there was a kind of magical imbuing of the European Union as having its esoteric roots as well, and then being
that's a story I didn't have as much time to go into. I would have liked to have gone into that a bit more. And I was helped a great deal by a book called the Zion Revelation by Lynn Picknett and Clive Prince, and they did an enormous amount of research tracing this influence of a strange esoteric political philosophy known as synarchy, which means total government. If anarchy is no government, synarchy is complete government. It's like, you know, everything is part of it. And there's a long sort of weird story about the roots of this, but there is some argument, or there's some evidence to suggest that sort of the original ideas for the European Union come out of this kind of synarchic political philosophy. And there were certain sort of shady synarchy groups at work sort of just before World War I, and then in the period between the two wars, Entre-deux Guerres, and even, you know, in relatively, you know, contemporary times. I mean, they argue that people like François Mitterrand somehow involved. And he actually, if you know Paris, it was during his time that all of these strange sort of occult-like or mystical, magical kinds of things started to get erected. He kind of redesigned what we can call the psychogeography of Paris to the same degree. You know, we all know the pyramid that's in the courtyard of the Louvre. Anyone who, you know, knows the Da Vinci Code knows about that. Well, Mitterrand was behind that. And then there's a fantastic tower called La Défense, which is this, it's sort of called a stargate, you know, in some way. So again, you know, how much, you know, is it crazy? Is it just conspiracy? Is it just a fun idea? Is there something behind it? I think it's a bit of all of these kinds of things. But I think many of these people that are, you know, in these positions of power, they are interested in this kind of thing.
And but I think where we want to put some vetting standards for our expanding team that you really put down really well, because there are wonderful things, and as a colleague Steve Behrman says, you know, sure it works in practice, but does it work in theory? Right. So this, you know, application, you know, and much that we hold dear and that is, you know, maybe in our own lineage, you know, because you talk about chaos magic and William S. Burroughs, and then the wonderful spoof Robert Anton Wilson, which was a great spoof of conspiracy theories and great things, and then but then our standards are where you talk, even going back to Norman Vincent Peale, you know, where it goes political right, where he wanted to get General Douglas MacArthur into the White House in the 1950s. He's anti-Kennedy. The protocols of Zion, you know, let's put some standards down here where, you know, where we've allowed our powers of imagination and our yearning for, you know, kind of magical participation and uniqueness to be hoodwinked and snookered over here, so that we're feeding, you know, and I'll toss it how Hillary Clinton really made the alt-right happen. All right, now back to you. All right, there we go. So just to put some standards, so for everybody on the table as these things swirl around us, you know, what would you like to put on the standard just now as a vetting criterion?
Well, I'm just trying to understand what you mean by that. I mean, is it, are you thinking about...
Where it goes political right, where it leads to the...
It's not so much that I'm, how shall I say it? Even though I am sympathetic to the occult, obviously I am. I've written 20 books about it, and I've been reading about it for over 40 years and writing about it for more than 20. But it's not so much, how shall I say it? It's not so much that I want to defend the occult. I just was absolutely fascinated when I started looking into this, that all this stuff was actually going on. And it's really, I don't talk about any conspiracy theory. I mean, you're the only conspiracy theories in the book are those held by some of the people that I write about. But this is all stuff that's just there. And what struck me was that it's so out in the open now. That's what struck me. So it struck, at one point, I just felt, and it was when I saw that... that article in the New York Times, where Evola's name checked, and I really felt like, my God, everything that's been on the outside, on the margins, on the fringes, is suddenly smack in the middle. And there's people that, obviously we know there are people working today that are on the opposite side, say, of the alt-right. There's the magical resistance. It's the witches against Trump. And, every month they do a binding spell to...
Right, but which kind of...
Something that you mentioned, you were talking about Dionne Fortune earlier, something like that as well.
But maybe what I mean by putting some standards on the table for understanding is that you go back, to the kind of roots of this chaos magic, how we can see it. And that and you call it postmodern because it cares nothing for facts or truth. It likes shock, right?
Well, I say, there's the thing. I think, it's one of the things that I think I can maybe sum up some of what you're saying here, because I sort of half tongue in cheek say that Trump is the singularity everyone's been waiting for. We're waiting for the singularity to happen. The singularity is something where our standards of reality change. At the center of a black hole, nothing works that we usually know in the normal world. And, in the sort of new age notion, the singularity at some point, down the line, we're going to, reach the new age and everything's going to be different there too. Well, I feel like, that's exactly what happened. Trump got elected. Everything is different now. And I'm not saying he made it so, but he, I'm trying to be objective. I'm trying to be a historian and a critical, analyst at the same time. And it just strikes me that he's a product of and an agent of at the same time, this, what we call the post-truth world now, the alternative fact world. And that's been a long time coming. Where we are now is the result of a historical process that goes back at least more than a century. It goes back to I would say sort of Nietzsche starts talking about it in the 1880s, this nihilism that's on its way, which is basically the pursuit of truth in the scientific sense, has arrived at the recognition that there is no truth with the capital T. All truth is relative, basically.
And the attack at politically correct and all that.
So you get, but that's, how should I say it? How I see it, as I see it, this in various different ways. There's been the occult kind of critique of science and reason and logic because, we've all found it a bit too constricting and limiting, and we've all had experiences and insights into aspects of reality that scientific approach is inadequate to, deal with, sufficiently and properly. So, in one sense, we're happy that, the notion of this kind of stable truth has been undermined. But the wonderfulness that we were all waiting to happen, the re-enchantment of the world that was going to come, that's not what's happening now. What's happening is that we realize that, anything goes. And when you have a situation like that, and if you have people that recognize that that's the case, and they have aims and objectives, and they will act accordingly. They'll take advantage of the situation in order to, achieve what they want to achieve. I think a lot of people have been blindsided by what's happened.
Yeah.
In the sense that, God, we don't know where we can stand anymore. I mean, obviously we all have our, own personal feelings and beliefs and all that. And, there's supporters and there's critics. But when it comes time to like, okay, prove it or show me that is true and that what I'm saying is not true, we don't know how to do that anymore. And that's a very dangerous position.
Right. And let me remind our listeners and our dedicated listeners just tuning in. This is the Visionary Activist Show. I'm Caroline Casey. Our splendiferous, crucial for now guest is Gary Lachman and his book that is coming out right now, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. I think it's essential reading just for lucidity and to understand, you know, complicity. There have been a number of, you know, I guess two or three interesting speakers at festivals and in publications who have been sort of saying, well, the shadow of the 60s is also what gave rise to now, which is kind of what you're doing, which is, you know, the once something moves from a response to a reaction, you know, then you get into trouble. The response of being creatively suspicious of the authorities and the New York Times and the whatever and rejecting that. But once it becomes like, no, then they do the spiral that you're kind of doing, which is, and that gave rise to the, you know, fake news, the cunning retrovirus of Trump to take, you know, anything that with which he's attacked and to inhale it and spew it back out. But you do a great thing also, you know, how are we complicitous, right? And how, you know, snookered and bamboozled. And so many people and Trump supporters and all of us, you know, get bamboozled by our desire to not be bamboozled. But you know, mention a crucial point, Hillary Clinton's speech in Reno, Nevada on August 25th, 2016, you know, where she accuses Trump and his people of prejudice and paranoia and, you know, anti-Semitism and white nationalism and a paranoid fringe. And they, that feeds the thing, right?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm saying what do you want to say? I mean, she handed Trump, the alt-right, and others a stick to hit her with several times. And so, you know, that's what it seemed like to me. And as you said, she sort of invented, or not invented, but put it on the map, put the alt-right on the map, put Pepe the Frog on the map, and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, we want to come back to Pepe the Frog.
Yeah.
But maybe, wherever you want to go, wherever you want to go.
No, I'm just going to say is that the whole idea that I don't know what you mean by the complicity so much is that, you know, if you want to look back, the whole idea, if you're going to fight monsters, you have to make sure you don't become a monster yourself.
Yes, exactly.
I think what we do have in the extremes of both right and left now is you have two monsters, really, because whereas, like, you know, personally, and there isn't a great deal of my own politics. In fact, I try to stay out of that. I'm just trying to do my job as a reporter or, you know, journalist, philosophical journalist, whatever you want to call it. And you mentioned lucidity. Well, I try to do that at the time. But I forgot where I was going with that.
let me take it back for 2 seconds.
Yeah.
Which is, you know, complicity meaning, you know, we whatever is going on, we are contributing to it.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, yeah.
But once we realize that, we can, you know, inhale back in. But you know, our rogue species in danger now of destroying so much life, you know, is addicted to having an enemy. And just understanding that the Mossad created Hamas, and I mean back to now. So to toss you back the narrative, you know, that Hillary Clinton inadvertently, by rah-rah-rah-ing, you know, fueled this. And you also mentioned when Richard Spencer is attacked by the Antifa guy, that goes viral in terms of generating support, right? That meaning aware of how we're feeding or pouring gasoline on something, you know, that serves those. Okay, now back to you.
But it's difficult not to sort of react, or it's difficult not to respond to things. And again,
well,
you know,
those are different things.
There's people that are just living, you know, out there, and they don't have the time to every day to think through all the time, and people just react. I mean, it's not the same thing, but I mean, I've already got a bit of, you know, flack from the book from people who haven't read it, just because they get the impression that it's anti-Trump or something like that. But the funny thing is I've also got lambasted by social justice warriors or people on that side because my interest in the occult, put it that way, or because some of the things I've written haven't been this kind of emblazoned very much on your sleeve. Yes, I believe in this, or you know what I mean? Is that, what I really don't like about this time is that you sort of have to show, you know, all the time, you know, what side you're on to some degree if you're having a conversation.
No, I think you've transcended that. You know,
that's what I'm trying to do. But I think I can do it now with you, and I can do it in the books. But if you sort of encountering, you know, just in life, people or online, even it's very easy to go, you know, and again, that's a dangerous thing because it makes this kind of, you know, divisiveness and polarization,
where right,
you have to be on one side or the other. And again, not to make very simplistic comparisons, but it is like the 30s when the 30s were, you had to be either, you know, either you're a communist or you're fascist, because the Western democracies, you know, proved themselves incapable of dealing with anything in, you know, I personally don't want to be in that situation. I think it's a very dangerous one. And again, it's like the 60s too. The 60s were like that too. You had, you know, if you're not part of the problem, if you're not part of the solution, you're part of the problem. Well, maybe somebody isn't part of one way or the other. Why do we have to get caught up in your story? But then again, it's very much about power these days. It's very much about, you know, wanting to have power. And I only talk about that on the right side in this context, because I didn't have the time and space to talk about it in sort of on the left side. But in some other things I've written, I've been unhappy recipient of sort of political correctness at different times, and you know, again, yeah, it's not a big deal, but it's something that's there, you know,
it's an important deal, because we do, you know, really in a sense want to dedicate to spiraling out of polarity, you know. Mm-hmm. And when we can see the Parkland youth from Florida being such authentic geniuses in that realm rising up, because every time, you know, liberal or, you know, but even the liberal press would go, aren't you mad about this person saying that mean thing about you? They're like, no, mm-hmm, we want to concentrate on this unifying story that invites everybody to sane, reverent common sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
Over there. So to be cool in that way. And I think, you know, where you have transcended and where the book is incredibly useful, let me pitch it again, Dark Star Rising, Magic and Power in the Age of Trump, is that, you know, to be informed is really great, to have informed, reverent curiosity, to have these conversations that transcend left and right. You know, and I love talking to, you know, a right-wing conservative at CPAC who's become a great buddy, you know, who said, what do you know about Edmund Burke? And I go, oh, not much. Oh. And he said, well, Edmund Burke said, you know, to the degree to which we cultivate inner responsibility, the fewer outer restrictions we need. And I go, this is a great conversation.
Oh, that's yeah, absolutely. Burke also wrote wonderfully about aesthetics and the sublime.
Yeah. I mean, these are conversations.
He was a critic of the French Revolution and all that. And
yeah. Well, but these are worthy conversing.
Oh, no, of course. I mean, that's the whole, that's exactly. I mean, but again, but you're right. But you seem to have to somehow get through a lot of, you know, flack and noise to get to the signal.
But we are the dedicated listeners, and I are bestowing upon you a fleck and harumphic composter, so that it all gets composted into nutrient for intelligent conversation right now.
Absolutely.
But I think it's also, yeah, Richard Spencer, because I did have friends come up to me saying, oh, you know, who are sort of progressive hippies in a way, you know, and said, oh, we found this wonderful thing called the alt-right. And I'm like, oh, Richard Spencer. And they go, no, it's not the right. It's the alt-right. I'm like, Lordy, please read this.
Well, I think the thing is that I suspect that because a lot of issues have been sort of bubbling, kind of simmering away, but not really being talked about openly, that, you know, question some of the values of, you know, whatever you want to call neoliberalism, I don't know, whatever you want to call it.
Something else.
The kind of, you know, open, everything's okay, you know, basically kind of attitude, let's say. And, you know, people have, you know, sort of felt some resistance to that, but they don't want to speak out because, oh, they'll get branded as being sort of far right and all that kind of stuff. But that's building up over time. And then you have something that allows that to be released. And I guess Trump's campaign, which in the beginning nobody thought he was going to win. I tell you the truth, though, and I'm not, you know, trying to make myself out to be a, you know, I was predicting it or not, but I just, as soon as I saw that he had entered, you know, the ring, I thought he was going to win. Because what makes most sense today, what makes the most sense that, you know, wouldn't a reality television president, you know, make the most sense today? Because the whole character of our culture these days, it's based on entertainment.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been a much more fun conversation with Bernie Sanders, but...
I'm just saying, just in terms of, well, again... I'm trying to look at it not in so much about who would be preferable and whose politics I personally feel more in line with, but what seemed to be the character of the time. Because one of the things I wanted to mention, we were talking about before, about how difficult it is to talk, is I say in the book, I think we've entered what Hobbes called the war of all against all, but he had it in the beginning of civilization. But we seem to have, you know, through all the, you know, the years of enlightenment and so on up to now, we seem in many ways, not necessarily, well, obviously there is violence, but at least in a verbal and an oral context, we see it all seems to be the war of all against all. And someone else who touches on that, and I touch on in the book, was Rudolf Steiner, you know, esoteric thinker and philosopher and so on. And the way he describes what the war of all against all would be about, and this is in a lecture, I think it was in 1908, but the way he describes it seems very much to me like not only, you know, this acrimonious non-discussion that's going on between, you know, two different sides, but the whole kind of scramble for attention on the internet. On getting likes, you know, in social media. Everyone's your competitor on Twitter and on Facebook and all these other things because, you know, they're getting likes and all that kind of thing too. And it does really seem that there is a kind of way in which we are in this kind of war of all against all.
Well, I do want to sort of throw a little liberating lightning at the circle, turn it into a spiral. But I want to come back to Trump's inauguration speech so that we kind of understand what was there. And, you know, George W. Bush said, you know, a word we can't say on the radio in America. But he said, man, that is some weird you know, because... Yeah, yeah. Just to bring in the America First, you know, just to understand, you know, if you are our liberating lucidity blazing guide here, that's right, and you don't have, you know, no sides, we're composting all sides, but there are things we must know if we are to make a common story and an invitation to a common story to preserve as much life as possible. All right, so now back to America First and Henry Ford and Charles Lindbergh and the anti-Semitism of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. Back to you, sir.
The America First speech was chilling. You know, but you know, we know not too long after that he went back on it. So I think, you know, one of the things is, again, if you read about Trump's life, as far as all the kind of sudden changes and going back on things and saying one thing, saying something else, which surprises everybody, or maybe they're not so much surprised by it now because they're used to it. But he was operating like that all along, you know, throughout his business career and things like that. You know, he's very, very good at using what's around at the time in order to get the effect he wants, and then he'll, you know, whatever he needs next, he'll move on to that. But of course, yeah, I mean, you know, Henry Ford, he was a staunch believer in the Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which is this rabid fraudulent text that was published in Russia, but I think it was originally written in France. Basically, you know, it's the whole story that there's this cabal of powerful Jewish businessmen that are planning, you know, world domination, and over time other people join them. You know, I think the Bolsheviks joined them at one point, and the Freemasons and so on and so on. But, you know, Ford was also a reader of Ralph Waldo Trine, who's one of the great early New Thought.
Right.
But the thing is, like, it's like, you know, the New Thought is there, yes, and you know, you can get people who have dubious aims in mind who make use of that. And then you have other people who don't. They have whatever, some personal benefit they're looking for, or maybe they even want to just, you know, bring peace to the world or something, and they're doing it too. So it's not so much to me that the technique, the idea is wrong in itself. I mean, we can say something banal. It's something that can be used. So we know the force is the light side of the force, and there's the dark side. And the dark side tends to be more sexy and attractive because it offers power. It offers power, and it offers, you know, basically power, it offers power, and it offers the visibility of power too.
And and a mission, and to be part of something large that bestows.
I'm saying, but you can do that too, and not be, you know.
Do that too, and not be toxic and kill the world.
And again, this is something I think that. What I say in the early chapter in the book, when I'm sort of comparing how political demagogues and gurus share quite a few sort of personality traits and sort of style, let's say. Again, I'm not saying all gurus are bad. They aren't, but there have been some pretty bad gurus. Just like not all politicians are bad. They aren't, but there have been some pretty
bad
politicians. But I was going to say that the point I'm trying to make is that why these people become attractive in many ways is because they do offer some sense of you becoming part of something larger than yourself, which I think on the left they tend to be suspicious of that. They don't like that idea. Everything is actually rather rational, tends to be. You know, there's rational self-interest, there's very visible, reasonable aims and goals. But as I quote, you know, George Orwell, when he was writing about Hitler's rise, he's saying, like, the one thing that's come through to him is that people don't want just, you know, shorter working hours or for the trains to run on time. They want to be involved in something that's heroic. They want to be involved in something that gives them a sense of meaning. And I think that's a good appetite. I think we have that. If you don't have that, you wind up in this kind of existential.
Right. No, it's where the good gets,
gets kidnapped. It can be taken advantage of. It can be manipulated and used. And sadly, this is what happens often, and especially on large scale, you know, movements like politics. I mean, what Lawrence Rees, wrote this wonderful book about Hitler, Hitler's dark charisma, or something like that. He says that the National Socialism wasn't a political. People didn't vote for National Socialism for political reasons. Because it was an emotional state. It provided an emotional state for them. And, you know, if you look at certainly many of the Trump rallies and things of that sort, that's many of the people who were in them seem to be, at least what I've seen, I haven't been to one myself, but at least what I've seen on television, and that could be fake news. So I can't guarantee it isn't, but I don't believe it is. But, you know, they have this kind of rapture, you know, about them and all that, which is very much, you know, lined up with the religious kind of thing. And
well, it is the issue of mob mind. And, you know, I mean, I have been at these rallies, and I think just to put on the work table, you know, it is a mob mind that kind of like, I don't know if you know the short story Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, you know, where people, in order to be nice, they hate somebody to death in the stadium. We go, whoa. But the mob mind, you know, the toxic form in whatever realm invites the worst of humans, you know, and it's even part of us say, I don't know what got into me. I don't know why I said that. I don't know why I have this pitchfork or the, you know. But so it behooves us to invite, you know, the best in some form. We're still good. We still have a luxury of, you know, 10 more minutes, I think. But do narrate, you know, Pepe the Frog. What's Pepe the Frog?
Well, Pepe the Frog, if you don't know by now, he was the invention of a cartoonist named Matt Fury. And I think it was Boyer's World or something like that, a comic of his. And he's an amphibian slacker, basically. And he started life. There was a picture of Pepe, sort of, you know, a frog with sort of human size, urinating in public, and, you know, someone walks by and says, "Oh man, why are you doing that?" And Pepe says, "Oh, it feels good, man." And that feels good, man, kind of thing got picked up apparently. And so, again, as happens on the net, memes, symbols, images, you know, phrases, whatever, little bits of culture. Get picked up, adopted, and transmitted and launched, and, you know, they start to have a career life of their own. Originally, Pepe was, you know, fairly innocuous, and you have pop people like Katy Perry or Nicki Minaj and some of these others, you know, pictures with him and that kind of thing. But you have this subculture of teenage online addicts who, by their own admission, live in their parents' basement, and they're so disaffected, and it's the whole rebel without a cause, but, you know, a 21st century version of that, and they just take pot shots at everything around them, and they tended to like Trump because Trump was the most, you know, he was like the ultimate computer online troll, and he was sort of, you know, he was the most politically incorrect thing going, and they were very keen on being politically incorrect because they basically just wanted to give the finger to, you know, all the straight people out there and all that. And somebody in that mix posted an image of Pepe looking over like sort of the Mexican border, kind of, and this was sort of like, oh, the wall, you know, that Trump is going to build, and you know, and you know, much of the rhetoric of people that are on 4chan and sites doing this, it's all, you know, it's all rather politically incorrect. It's all, you know, it can be racist, it's sexist, it's, you know, it's all the kind of stuff that, you know, we're not supposed to like, and so they were, as teenagers do, they were reveling in it. But strange things started to happen, and going back a little bit before Pepe entered the picture, is you have these people were really fascinated with the Dark Knight Rises, that film, the Batman film, and they had posted the opening, you know, scene where Bane, you know, the bad guy, he's ostensibly being transported by the, you know, the authorities, but actually he's in charge, and you know, he takes over and so on and so on, and crashes the plane and you know, and all that stuff happens, and then they were posting images from that beginning quite a bit on there. And then they started, and then not long after that, they had the horrible Angel German Wings 9545 flight, 924, whatever the number is, crash in the French Alps. And people that were into the Bane posting noticed these weird coincidences that, you know, one of the towns near where the crash was is called Bane. One of the crash investigators, his name is Bruce Robin. You know, so Batman's secret identity is Bruce Wayne and Robin's his sidekick. It turns out, you know, that the plane was crashed on purpose, and that happens in the film too. So in their morbid adolescent way, they started joking about, hey, you know, guys, look, are we making things happen? Hmm. You know, by posting this stuff, are we making things happen? And around the same time, you had the Slender Man phenomena too, where the sort of invented, you know, character, online sort of character, either, you know, either popped out into the real world, or, you know, someone was doing what he was doing, you know, and so on. So somebody christened this synchro mysticism, which is basically a, you know, a techno update on C.G. Jung's term synchronicity. What's a synchronicity? A synchronicity is a meaningful coincidence. It's when something happening in your head is reflected out in outer world, and it has a absolutely direct, indubitable, meaningful connection with you, but there's no possible way that it could have any kind of true causal connection. So that's why we say, oh, what a coincidence. But it's somehow, it's not just a coincidence, it has a real kind of aura of significance about it, and they're difficult to shake.
But I'm not willing to give up the word mysticism. I prefer to call it psychic psychotic, so close together.
Call it whatever you want. I'm just saying, yeah, this is what these people, right, you know, were calling it. And the whole idea was, as I say in the book, if you think of the internet as a kind of exteriorized imagination, just as sort of iPods are a kind of exteriorized interior world that we carry around with us on our heads. Just as in sort of synchronicity proper, something happening in the mind is shown to be out in the world at the same time. So how did that happen? Well, they transpose that to the internet. Something happening in the internet has an effect on the outer world. And so I guess people thought, well, if this can happen by chance, what if we try to do it on purpose? And what happened was that, again, going back to chaos magic, because this meme magic that the alt-right are said to have used to get Trump into office, or, you know, whether they believe that it did, it's an offshoot of chaos magic. And I said before how chaos magic uses whatever's at hand. Well, what's most at hand is the internet. And so instead of mucking about with, you know, circles and cells, spells and candles and, you know, wands and all that business, they just started, these meme magicians just started, you know, posting images of Pepe, and Pepe became a kind of, yeah, magical sigil. It became a symbol that carried, you know, their intent, which is what, you know, a sigil is.
Well, you said that Pepe the Frog became a cute swastika.
Well, I say how amphibian, you know, slacker became a kind of postmodern swastika. It's a story that requires
telling. And sort of inhales and kidnaps the Church of the Subgenius, where slacker.
I mean, again, like, you know, there's probably lots of people out there saying, oh man, this dude, he thinks we were serious. So God, you know, we really got it over him and all that. But, you know, this is the story.
Right.
And I personally, myself, someone who, as many of us do, I've experienced many synchronicities, and I've experienced many that have been so, you know, spot on, as they say here, that I just can't shake the fact that it just wasn't a coincidence. Just something must be going on.
No, that's absolutely.
How they happen, I don't know. I'm not, and I've never been convinced by any, you know, quasi-scientific explanation. Even Jung, you know, the whole idea of somehow quantum physics being involved, it just doesn't do it.
Well, but we live in a conversational creation that everything's speaking to us all the time by shape and
form. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
We'll get back to it next week. All right. But I think it's also important, you know, these tools, that the idea of cultivating our considerable skills, and you delineate the, you know, the powers of visualization and stuff, which we might just say is true, but because before us is, you know, it's not like, you know, just the focus for many, you know, on how do we get rid of Trump, you know, it's like, no, how do we dispel what gave rise, you know, and liberate,
well,
you know,
even more than either of those things, if it really is the case that, you know, the mind and the world interpenetrate rather than what the West has believed for the last 400 years, that there's a strict separation between the two, you know, begins with Descartes and obviously John Locke. John Locke tells us that there's nothing in the mind that wasn't first in the senses.
That's why we're going to put a key in Locke.
Well, the way I, to not make too bad of a pun, but I think if we want to be serious about this, we have to unlock our minds in the sense that not only open them, but to get past that idea that we're not tabula rasa, that there is something there in the first place. And that on top of that, that kind of strict separation, according to many philosophers and thinkers, mystics and esotericists, people I've been writing about for years, and in a couple of my books I sort of chart their ideas out, they're saying no, that Cartesian separation that we know is the mind-body, you know, dualism, that's a historical product in the evolution of consciousness, and consciousness is evolving. And what I say in the book, and I've said in other places in interviews, is I think we're going through what I have to mention another philosopher named Jean Gebser. He's a German-Swiss philosopher who died in 1973, but he wrote this remarkable book in the 40s called The Ever-Present Origin. And I can't go into detail about it, but what he says is what the West is now experiencing, and again, I say he was writing in the 40s, was what he called the breakdown of the mental rational structure of consciousness. And that's precisely, you know, what we've taken as consciousness as it is, consciousness per se, since sort of the rise of the Enlightenment and all that. And it's what I just said. You have an outer world that's physical, measurable, quantifiable. It's there. It's completely oblivious, you know, to us. And each of us has a little puddle of consciousness, you know, in our heads, as it were, you know, metaphorically.
Well, yeah.
Well, that's a particular picture that's arisen over time. But I charted in my books, many other people have written about it, and say, well, actually, you know, it may not be exactly the case. And if it isn't the case, then the partitions between the two are not as strong as we've been led to believe. And as I say, what happens in the mind doesn't necessarily always stay there.
Right. You know? And in our last 2 minutes here, to touch on that, you know, you do bring up the powerful concept of the egregore and Dion Fortune, and, you know, and Alexandra David Neal, when she goes to Tibet, you know, one of the exercises is to conjure a being, and she...
A topa.
Yeah, she creates a monk, right, not a traditional thing, and it gets a little... It gets, she says, so strong people walking into the room perceive it as a being, and then it gets a little sly, and her teacher says, you know, tusk, it's going to take you 6 months to dematerialize it.
Yeah.
So the egregore, you know, the thought form, the living thought form. Okay, in our last minute here, do you want to just touch on the egregore as we...
Well, the egregore is a kind of a being that's brought in, it's brought about by a group mind, basically. You have a group of people that devote their, you know, imagination and thought and concentration on this kind of being, that they bring it into existence. But then over time, it develops a life of its own.
Absolutely.
And, it starts to take over the followers.
Right. It's a place we got to leave it because it's a completely open door for
the last thing I want to say, though, the thought form created by a single person is called a tulpa. And I do ask in the book, I wonder, can we consider Trump a tulpa or something?
Yes.
He's been pulled out of the television.
Right. Yeah, that's great. No, that's a very useful and workable image. And do you really teach at the California Institute of Integral Studies on occasion? Whoops.
I do an online course with them. It just started.
All right. We got to go. We're having too
much. Okay. My pleasure. Thank you.
Right. Thank you so much, Gary Lachman. His website is garylachman.co.uk. Author of his latest book, Dark Star Rising: Magic and Power in the Age of Trump. Interesting and essential reading, really, forever. Thank you very much, Gary.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you.
Why should the black man in America concern himself, since we've been away from the African continent for 400 years, 300 or 400 years? Why should we concern ourselves? What impact does what happened?